It's 8:45. Okay, we shall begin.
Okay,
so today, we're going to get into some of the meat of this in adjudication. So I thought that we would start with a discussion about Hasagas Gavul cases. These are cases for unfair business competition, typically referred to as Hasagas Gavul, based on the pasuk in the Torah in Sefer Dvarim, Lo Tasu Gavul Ve'Achasher Gavul Vishorim. That you're not supposed to encroach, you're not supposed to trespass on another person's property. So quite literally, Hasagas Gavul refers to taking a property boundary marker and moving it beyond where it belongs so that it appears as if what was really somebody else's property is part of your property since you moved the boundary marker further along. This particular prohibition is obviously gezeila. It's a prohibition of stealing on some level. It's a stealing of real estate and is technically only applicable in Eretz Yisrael. Outside of Israel, if somebody did that, they would be stealing, but they wouldn't be also in violation of this additional transgression of Lo Tasu Gavul Ve'Achasher. However, various Sfarim, including the Sefer HaRokeach, understand that there's an additional level of interpretation that we derive from Lo Tasu Gavul Ve'Achasher that actually does encompass this idea of encroaching upon somebody else's business turf, encroaching upon somebody else's business territory, that somehow, at least on some basic moral and ethical level, is also included in what the Torah is conveying through this transgression. So even if it doesn't end up being an issa d'oraisa, maybe it's an issa d'rabbanan, maybe it's as indicated in the Gemara at the end of Maseches Makos, where we speak about it, there were 613 mitzvos, and various people came along, and they consolidated the 613 mitzvos, and midan al achas srei, and midan al shosh, and midan al echos, that there are different ways of condensing and consolidating the Tarjag mitzvos in David HaMelech. Among the various ways that he consolidated the 613 mitzvot, so included in that is this notion of not encroaching upon somebody else's livelihood. So if you understand that the Gemara there is really just condensing all of the Torah into certain ethical notions, so then you would say, well, it's an ethical notion. It's not necessarily an actual halakha. If you understand, no, it's just like the 613 mitzvot are real genuine mitzvot. So if we're summarizing them or condensing them into categories, into broad sweeping categories, so each one of those categories represents a real genuine binding prohibition as well. You say, well, maybe it is a real genuine prohibition. So one way or another, it's generally assumed that either as an ethical norm or as an actual transgression, to the degree in which we would categorize something as Hasagas Gavul, as a prohibition of Hasagas Gavul, there would be a real transgression, there would be a real prohibition that would be involved. The question is, when does the prohibition actually apply? Is it a null set where really the amount of conditions that would need to be satisfied in order for the prohibition to be triggered are so impossible to meet that it's virtually never triggered? Or is there perhaps a more substantial set of cases where you have a real problem according to halakha of unfair business competition? Now this is important in terms of Bezdin adjudication because even if you go back in time, say 20, 30, 40 years, when Batin Din rabbinical courts in this country, in America, were not all that busy, were not all that active as they are nowadays, I would say. I think that Batin Din have become more active in terms of commercial adjudication, in terms of dealing with business disputes, in terms of kosher mishpah cases. But if you go back, 30 years in American history, American Bezdin history, the truth of the matter is that Batin Din weren't really utilized that much. So to the degree that people would go to Bezdin, Bezdin was viewed as kind of an archaic, antiquated institution. You'd go to it if you needed a get, you needed a chalitza, you needed something that was very specialized in terms of Jewish ritual. But in terms of adjudicating disputes, people didn't use the Batin Din so much. I don't know, I can't explain to you fully that why that was. Maybe because the American Jewish community just took a while to get up to speed in terms of observing all the mitzvahs, just like for a period of time people weren't observing Taharas HaMishpacha so perfectly, people weren't observing Tefillas Kehillim so perfectly, all kinds of things that have fallen by the wayside, and eventually people became more frum, and the community moved more to the right, and became more well-informed, and the children became more educated in yeshivas, and people kept have to started to observe more mitzvot. So somewhere along the line, somebody noticed, oh yeah, there's a prohibition that we're not supposed to adjudicate our disputes in secular court. We should really go to Bez Din, and we should establish Bati Din. So that's one reason that Bati Din have become more active and weren't utilized so much. But another reason was, I think, that people just did not have a confidence level that Bati Din was sufficiently in touch and capable of dealing with the realities of the modern day commercial marketplace. However, there were two types of cases that even back then people would still bring to Bati Din. One case, one type of case was a case where the transaction was essentially shady in nature, where it was all money under the table, and if the Reuven, who felt that he had been swindled by Shimon in terms of their under the table deal, had brought Shimon to civil court, so they would have both ended up behind bars. So that's one good reason to bring the case to Bez Din instead. But another type, a real cookie cutter case that would typically go to Bez Din, even in the olden days, was Hasagah Shvuah cases of unfair business competition. And the reason why they were brought to the rabbinical courts rather than to the civil courts, even if the parties weren't so observant, and even if they brought other cases to the civil court, was because they knew that the plaintiff knew that if he or she would bring such a case in front of the civil court, they would be laughed out of the courtroom. Because in America, we have a sweeping principle of free enterprise, which is unbridled competition. And it's okay if you have a pizza store that opens up on one side of the block for another pizza store to open up on the other side of the block. That's called America. That's called the land of the free, where everybody has the opportunity to make a living and to drive the next person out of business, and a survival of the fittest, at least in the business world. So therefore, such a claim would not be sustainable in civil court. But the feeling was it would be sustainable in Bez Din. To a certain degree, this was a misconception, because if you look at the original sugya in the Gemara, you go to the actual sugya of Hasagah Shvuah in the Gemara in Baba Basra, you see that as a general principle, halacha is very similar to the secular law, meaning that halacha really, for the most part, does believe in free enterprise and in unbridled competition and in the ability for people to compete against each other. The only question is whether the Gemara builds in certain exceptions to that rule, whether it builds in certain exceptions to that principle. So that's what we really every single Bez Din has to contend with when there are cases of this sort that are born in front of a Bez Din. What's your typical case, a Sugar School case that comes in front of the Bez Din, your typical cookie cutter case? The typical cookie cutter case is a pizza parlor case, right? So that's the first question that I have presented over here. And we could think about the sugya and from the vantage point of this type of case. Every single one of the cases and scenarios that I have outlined here in today's Chabura sheets are all cases that have come in front of the Bate Din, in which I have been involved over the years. Meaning that nothing here is really completely made up. They're all cases that, on some measure, have come in front of us. So the first case is a kosher pizza parlor named Pizza Perfect that's been doing brisk business in a small Orthodox community for 20 years. Suddenly, on the same block in which this store has been operating, a new kosher pizza store named Pizza Plus open, selling cheaper pizza, okay? So we already see that there's one difference between the pizzas. They're selling cheaper pizza with a crust that is thinner, in the opinion of many customers, also tastier than the existing pizza. So we have, number one, a competitive pizza. Number two, the pizza is cheaper. Number three, the pizza's crust, according to some, it tastes a little bit better. In addition, Pizza Plus doesn't sell exactly the same type of products in its store. It's a little bit of a differentiated enterprise. It sells pastas and fancy salads, while Pizza Perfect is limited to pizza and falafel, because if you're perfect, you don't really need to expand. The longtime owner of Pizza Parlor argues that Pizza Perfect, that his competitors engaged in a Sugar School ruinous business competition, since his customers are both leaving on their own and are being actively recruited by the Pizza Plus ownership to defect to the new pizza store and wants the Beit Din to close the new pizza store. So here we have something else. That Pizza Perfect claims that they're losing business because some of their customers are just going on their own to Pizza Plus. But in addition, they're making another claim, and that claim is that the Pizza Plus management is actively soliciting some of the Pizza Perfect longstanding customers to leave Pizza Perfect and to go and patronize Pizza Plus.
What does that mean? Actively
patronizing. They're going to them as they see them walking into the store and saying, "Hey, why are you walking into Pizza Perfect? Look at the wonderful the gimmick and the wonderful special feature and sale that we have this week on buy one, get one free, whatever it is, and our product is so much tastier. Then instead of walking in there, why don't you change your pizza place and come and patronize us instead?" The Honor Pizza Plus points out, or maybe they're sending out leaflets to people in the community saying, we know that up until now you've been frequenting Pizza Perfect, but we want you to know about our new pizza place and come to us instead. The Honor Pizza Plus points out, this is his defense, that he is selling a different type of pizza and argues that greater pizza competition will enhance the commercial market and benefit both establishments. He also argues that the Pizza Perfect owner has many other businesses to fall back upon. He's not going to lose his entire livelihood. He might lose his pizza store, right? But he has other things to do, you know? Maybe he's a doctor on the side. How should the case be decided? How do you go and decide this particular conundrum? So this is really the standard fare that comes in front of Batika. Now I'll throw in another wrinkle, which is that often, but a fair amount of the time, the way in which such cases are presented to the Bate Din is that they are actually referred by the local kashrus establishment, local kashrus agencies, because any new store that opens up will want to receive a hashgacha, they want to receive kashrus certification. And the kashrus certifications don't want to get in the midst of a major imbroglio over whether halakha permits the second store to open or not. So they say, we'll only grant our hashgacha on the second store if the din Torah, the dispute between the first store and the second store, is resolved by the following Beis Din. So they're the ones who will actually refer the matter to a particular Beis Din, and if the Beis Din rules that the second pizza store is allowed to open up, so then we'll grant our hashgacha. So it's actually very interesting the way that it comes to the Beis Din. It's not necessarily even referred by the parties themselves. Sometimes it's the hashgacha agency that actually refers the matter to the Beis Din. So if you look at the basic sugya is in Bava Basa, the Kratav Kofal from a base, you have a machlokas really between Makuna and Mafuna Breda of Yeshua. Mafuna says, let's say that I have two people who live in a neighborhood. They live in an alleyway, okay? They live in Parkside Estates or whatever. A little alleyway, you walk in, okay, and there's like a limited area where people function over there. And one person in that alley decides that he's going to set up a mill. An old-time store is called a mill. People would have mill, and they would, you know, grind flour, wheat into the mill and make flour, and, you know, they would use their mills. Nowadays, we don't have mills so much, so we have stores, okay? So the equivalent of an old-time mill would be a modern-day store, a pizza parlor, okay? So somebody else wants to set up the mill. Tinu Namaki Veluya, the first guy who already set up shop in the mavoi, in the alleyway, can say that in this little neighborhood area, can say, I don't want to allow the second person to open up the business. The Amalei, because he could say, it's going to take away my livelihood. So now the Gemara brings a proof for the position of Rav Huna. Lema Misayale. Let's try to bring a proof for Rav Huna. If I have a fisherman who spreads a net, and now the various fish are swimming towards his net, so say the other fishermen are not allowed to spread out their nets in the same area. And that would appear to also lend support for Rav Huna's principle that one person who sets up shop is allowed to prevent another person from setting up shop in the same neighborhood, in the same business. So says the Gemara, no, maybe fish are different. So here already we have the possibility, so maybe we can generally hold that competition would be okay unless it's a situation similar to fish. Why are fish different? What's so fishy about fish? So Shani Dagim, the Yavi Sierra, because the fish already have granted their gaze. They've already pointed their gaze towards the first fisherman's net, and they're heading in that direction. So what's so special about the Yavi Sierra? So here, if you look at the second source, which is Rashi, and the third source, which is Tosfos, they have different theories as to what the problem is with respect to the fish. Says Rashi that once the fisherman spreads out his net, Batuachu, this is the last two lines in Rashi, Batuachu Shiokedenu, he's absolutely positive that he's going to be able to trap these fish that would be heading towards his net. Davalei Kamanda Matil Yodi, it's as if he already has landed the fish. V'nimtza Chavera Maziko. Therefore, it's as if the other person is causing a direct harm. The person who sets up the second shop is taking fish that he effectively, first fisherman, effectively already has in his possession, and is doing the equivalent, not exactly the same thing, but he's doing constructively the equivalent of grabbing those fish away from him, so therefore that's considered to be maziko. But in the case of the two competing store owners, maybe that's not quite as bad, because of al-hacha, mishabai etzli yavo, mishabai etzli chal yavo. Nobody's grabbing away anything from from anybody else. Each store owner can say, the second store owner can say, anybody who wants to continue to go to your mill can go to your mill. Somebody wants to go to my mill, go to my mill. Similarly with the pizza owners. The Pizza Plus person can say, anybody who wants to continue going to Pizza Perfect can do so, and anybody who wants to come to my store, Pizza Plus can do so. So the Gemara compares that case to the store owner saying that maybe that's similar to machlokas between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim. Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim says, have a dispute about whether a store owner is allowed to entice children, okay, to want to come to their store. So if they're shopping with their mommies, they say, oh, mommy, please stop in that store because this store owner gives us candies, okay? So if they give out lollipops. So the old-time equivalent of giving out lollipops to small children was giving out nuts, okay? Kids were nuts about nuts in the old days. They used to love parched corn. Wow, parched corn, like Sugar Smacks. It goes in, and they would have walnuts. So that was like the greatest thing you could give little children. So says Rabbi Yehuda, that's not right. You're going to entice the children away from other stores. Well, Yechalek Kanvani, a store owner is not supposed to give the clayas that goes in the parched corn and the walnuts to the tinokas, to the small children, Neshamar Gila Netzlo, because now the children will only want to go to that store, and it's not fair to the other stores. So Chachamim Matirin, the Chachamim, however, say that's perfectly fine. So it says the Gemara, no, maybe when it comes to there, that particular situation, we could say everybody has an equal advantage, meaning that on some level, when everybody has an equal advantage, nobody's going to argue that there is really a problem, because there the Chachamim, even the Rabbanan would say that that case is different. To Amalei Anakim Mefagina, that you're going to give out for store owner who's giving out walnuts can say, I'm giving out walnuts, you give out almonds, or you give out hazelnuts, right? That that each one can give out treats to the children and thereby entice the children. But maybe here, when it comes to the competing store owners of just opening up an entire business altogether that didn't exist, where a person had a niche in the marketplace of selling a particular product, maybe there's more of an argument to say, that the person can say that you are destroying my livelihood. So here, there is the possibility then that there are different gradations. There's some gradation where we say that I have existing store owners where nobody questioned their right to be able to exist. And the only question is whether they're allowed to throw in sales gimmicks and the like. We say everybody has the ability to throw in zip and sales gimmicks. That's not going to destroy anybody's livelihood. And then I have sort of an extreme case in the other direction where somebody has already landed through their efforts and their toil. They already have landed certain customers and the other person is actively taking away those customers, like the case of the fisherman where second fisherman is actively taking away fish that the other person already had, that maybe that everybody would agree falls into the category of destroying a livelihood that would be a sagas gvul problem. And the only real machlokas is this intermediate case that we say, oh, just because somebody has opened up a store in one area that we're going to categorically prohibit somebody else from opening up a similar store, even if they're not going to grab customers away from them, right? So the Gemara ends up saying that this is really a machlokas tanaim. And the machlokas tanaim is reflecting a machlokas amoraim that Rav Huna's view is disputed by Rav Huna Breid Rav Yeshua. That's the last three lines here. I'm Rav Huna Breid Rav Yeshua. Pshitali, he says, it's obvious to me that b'masa acharisi matzim yakid, that if I have a person who lives in a city, I have a large city, and people pay taxes, they have the right to live in that city and to do business in that city, and now I have an interloper, I have somebody who comes from another city and they want to do business in that city, so that for sure, that's going beyond the line. That nobody, that person doesn't have a right to take away the rights and privileges that pertain to the individuals who already live in that city. Unless that person pays taxes. If that person who's going to come in from the outside is now going to be subject to the same responsibilities and obligations of everyone else who lives in the city, and they're also going to pay taxes in order to do business in the city, so then that's perfectly fine. However, he says, for sure, if two people live in the same city, they live in the same neighborhood, and they both want to operate competing mills, no problem. One person opened up a mill, second person wants to open up a mill, not a problem at all. Then he asks the question, what if, however, the person who's opening the competing business, it doesn't originally come from my neighborhood, they come from my city, and they pay the taxes, but they want to compete within my neighborhood. Is that okay or is that not okay? So that's not resolved. So that's left as a teiku. And Tosfos says, if you look at source number 4, Tosu says, well, since this is not resolved, nonetheless, we are the Kabase Kaimalan, the Gavi Rafuna de Basru. Nonetheless, we go sort of in a lenient direction when it comes to mominus, when it comes to money matters. We go in a lenient direction and we say that it's not fair to impose upon the person who wants to open up the second business if we're not entirely sure that we should prohibit them. Therefore, we can't prohibit them. And even in that case of one person from another neighborhood opening up a business in my neighborhood, if we both belong to the same city, that would be okay. Now, some of the later posts can point out that this restriction that even Rav Huna Brei Rav Yeshua agrees to, that if somebody's coming from an outside city and they want to compete against the people who are already the city dwellers, says that that also is not applicable nowadays, because nowadays everybody pays whatever are the pertinent taxes that you would have to pay if you come in from another city. And also he says that it's not as if somebody comes in from the outside to do business that it's going to raise anybody else's tax burden. That's what the Minchas Tzvi, or Tzvi Spitz from Eretz Yisrael, says. There's no impact, no adverse impact it has on anybody else's tax burden. So therefore, this was not the type of restriction that Rav Huna Brei Rav Yehoshua was talking about. So it would seem, according to the Maskan of the Gemara, according to Rav Huna Brei Rav Yehoshua, that there is no restriction, that we would allow pretty much unbridled competition in almost any situation that you could envision. Yes?
Does the size of the market, the type of the market, make any difference?
So this is what the later posts can talk about. They say, first of all, have we left any windows open? Meaning that if you look in the Shulchan Aruch itself seems to accept the most lenient or broadest free enterprise interpretation of the Gemara. Meaning that at the end of the day, we hold like Rav Huna Brei de Rabbi Yehoshua, just like the store, each storekeeper that already has a viable business can enter into their own marketing gimmicks by giving away walnuts or almonds, as the case may be. It could even be chocolate walnuts and chocolate almonds. It could even be fidget spinners that they're going to give to the children who frequent their store. So too, we also say that if somebody wants to open up a competing business, that everybody can simply try to maximize market conditions for their own benefit, and every single person has the same business opportunities, and therefore we're not going to preclude anybody from entering into the market. Or we can say that the Gemara did not necessarily explicitly reject this exceptional case of the fish and the fisherman's nets. And if I had some sort of situation which was equivalent to the fisherman's nets, where there was such an egregious type of violation, that I would still have the potential for a Hasagas Gavul prohibition. So what is the nature of the fisherman nets? Really, when you think about it, it's very important to focus on this. Let's go back to the first sources again, source 2 and source 3. So we saw Rashi said the problem with the fisherman's net is Nimsa Chaver Maziko, that it's as if the first fisherman already has, by virtue of all of his work and his toil and his effort and his energy, has already trapped the fish that are heading towards his net by virtue of setting up the net. And therefore, if somebody else comes along and puts another net in the passageway where the fish are already swimming in that direction, he's taking advantage of somebody else's hard work and toil, and he's grabbing away the fish that already were effectively coming into the first fisherman's possession. So therefore, that's a mazik. That's something which is almost in the realm of gezel, and therefore would not be permitted. That's what Rashi says. Look at Tosos. Tosos says that maybe we can distinguish the case of the fisherman net in a different fashion, because the fisherman net poses a different problem according to Tosos. Tosos, there's a general sugya in the Gemara and Kiddushin called Ani Amahapech B'Charara. Ani Amahapech B'Charara means I have a poor person who is trying to grab a cookie, okay? Right? A poor person trying to grab a cookie, and then somebody else grabs that cookie away, even though the poor person was already kind of putting his hand on the cookie, the cookie was rolling, he was kind of, you know, trying, he was Mahapek Bacharara, he was trying very hard to pick up this cookie. And somebody else comes along and he grabs the cookie away from the poor person, and that's not a nice thing to do. So the Gemara says that somebody who grabs it's like taking candy from a baby, whatever, somebody who grabs the cookie from the poor person is considered to be a rasha, is considered to be a wicked person. So Rabbeinu Tam has an opinion. This is in opposition to Rashi. Rabbeinu Tam is of the opinion that this prohibition only applies when you're dealing with a business transaction, where one person is already in the course of completing a business transaction, and somebody else grabs that business opportunity, grabs that merchandise away from him. That's considered to be a Maaser Rishus. That's considered to be a wicked thing to do. Why is that? It's considered to be wicked because the second person could have bought the merchandise at the same price somewhere else because the merchandise is readily available. It's like a piece of real estate. So, you know, somebody else is closing on this piece of real estate, you could buy a different piece of real estate. Except, he says, if it's, yes?
And again, I don't know what the halachic ramifications are. One of the reasons we allow for what's called a specific performance remedy in real estate and civil law is because every piece of real estate is considered unique. No house, no plot of land is exactly
Let's say it's one of the houses on Parkside Estate. It's all identical. Okay, so you don't buy this one, you could buy the next one. But Rabbeinu Tam says, however, if we're talking about hefker, we're talking about something which is ownerless property. It's like a rare opportunity, like a rare metzias. We say that it's just a lost diamond that is lying on the rough. And who knows if there's ever going to be another diamond available like this. And it's not as if you could just find gold or diamonds any single day that you want. It's not a business opportunity. It's just a tremendous metzias. It's like hefker. It's an owner piece of ownerless property that's of tremendous value. So then, since if the person doesn't grab it now, they're not necessarily going to find another opportunity. So then all bets are off. And even though somebody else might be in the process of finalizing or closing on their acquisition, if somebody else can come along and grab it, that's fair game. That's perfectly fine. So Tosfos asks, so why isn't the fisherman net a kind of like that? Because in the fisherman net case, who says that the person is going to be able to find the fish somewhere else? This is not fish that are being acquired, it's fish that are being caught by a fisherman. So Tosfos gives another a couple of answers to that. Tosfos says that this is because Lokasha, the Apagav, look at the last two lines of Tosfos, source 3, to Apagav, to Havi Dava Shel Hefker, Mikol Malka Mekama Mekoma Siyimtza Shiyukal Lefos Misuda. So he says, even though it's ownerless property, but there are many fish in the sea, right? I think that's what we tell people, like after they break up a dating relationship, there are many fish in the sea, and it's not necessarily that this fish, you know, it's true that you can't necessarily count on the fact that any fish is going to want to come to you, and it's not something that you could just buy and have the fish come to you. You have to actually spread a net and have the fish, you know, want to come into your net. But nonetheless, there's so many fish in the sea that you don't have to worry if you lose these fish, that you're never going to be able to catch another fish. And then Tosfos brings another answer, and the second answer is interesting. Tosfos says, "But the hokom nasa b'ka." Tosfos says, "No, but also this is the person's profession." So it sounds a little bit like when you are dealing with a person's profession, there is a level of ripping away the individual's livelihood that we would say is considered to be pasata l'chiyusa, is considered to be where you're actually taking away the person's livelihood entirely, and then it's going to be prohibited. Meaning that we would draw a distinction, and this is a distinction that the Qasam Sofer draws, between chulsha l'chiyusa and pasata l'chiyusa. When are you just making a person's livelihood more difficult and more challenging, which is okay? And when are you taking away the person's livelihood entirely? Meaning that I have a school of fish that are all heading towards the first net. Somebody else comes along and says, wow, I have an entire school of fish. I'll just put this net right in front of the other net, and I'll get all of them. And the other guy is going to get nothing. He's going to be completely out of business. So it could be that maybe that case would be proscribed. That case would be prohibited according to halacha. And that is, in fact, the opinion of the Abi Yosef. So if just skip to source number 7, okay? Skip to source number 7. Source number 7 is the opinion of the Abi Yosef. The Abi Yosef is quoted as follows. Kasim and Mordechai, the Beis Yosef quotes this. Kasim and Mordechai, Mava Yasasim, Shloshet Stadin. Let's say I have a closed alleyway. So if I have a closed alleyway and somebody is selling eggs, let's say, in the far end of the alleyway, and everybody in the community wants eggs, they go to Mr. Eggman, who's on the far end of the alley, and they buy their eggs, okay? Now, somebody else moves into the neighborhood, and they set up an egg store, okay? A store, which is at the opening entrance of the alley. alleyway. Mm-hmm. And now, if the people want to buy eggs, they don't have to go to the end, to the far end of the closed alleyway. They could just go to the entranceway of the closed alleyway, and they have no incentive since it's an undifferentiated product, right? It's a homogeneous product. It's an egg. An egg is an egg is an egg. And the people have absolutely no incentive to go all the way to the end of the alleyway to buy the eggs from Mr. Eggman when they could buy the eggs from Mr. Kinegan Man, who's at the entranceway of the alleyway and is selling exactly the same product. So that, he says, you're going to take away Mr. Eggman's business 100%. You can't do that. He says, Amavan Yasasam Shloshit Sudden Rakbat Sadeka, you cunstle of a dar, Ruben ain't so so for a sasam. Ruben, Mr. Eggman, is at the far end. Rashimon Dorkenegat at such an ego yakole lech, Imloyak lech, Tahila, if they pass up Shimon. Anybody who's going in to buy the eggs is going to have to pass by Shimon's house and egg store first. So in such a case, the Abi Yosef says that of course Reuven can stop Shimon from opening up his business because he's going to put him out of business entirely. However, interestingly enough, the Beis Yosef, who, as you know, also doubles, you know, as Superman, as the Shulchan Aruch, right? So the Beis Yosef writes that it seems to him that this Abi Yosef is going according to the opinion of whom? In the Gemara, we have a machlokas between Rav Huna and Rav Huna Breid Rav Yeshua. He says he thinks that his opinion is going according to Rav Huna, which is the one who says that there's such a thing as unfair business competition according to halakha within a neighborhood, but we don't paskin that way. Says Rav Yosef, so the local Rav Huna Breid Rav Yeshua, he's not paskin like Rav Huna Breid Rav Yeshua. Him came the dog, so according to us, the Kaimaran Rav Huna Breid Rav Yeshua, that we hold by Rav Huna Breid Rav Yeshua, even in such an extreme and egregious case, Reuven would not be able to prevent Shimon from opening up his competing business. So that's how he paskins. And if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, in fact, you don't find any remnants, you don't find any hint to this opinion of the Abi Yosef.
So never a case?
It would appear to be virtually never a case, except that this was resuscitated, this opinion of the Abi Yosef was resuscitated by the Ramat. If you turn to source number 10, I basically gave you the Shulchan Aruch outside. You turn to source number 10, the Piskei Tshuva, the commentary, of course, to the Shulchan Aruch. So he quotes a Ramah. So you figure, what do I need the Piskei Tshuva to quote a Ramah? The Ramah's on top of the page. Piskei Tshuva's on the bottom of the page. Piskei Tshuva quotes people who aren't on the page altogether. I don't need to quote a Ramah. Thing is that the Ramah himself didn't quote himself. The Ramah, in his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, doesn't talk about the Abi Yosef, but the Ramah also wrote responsa. He wrote Tshuvos. Tshuvos are not on the page. So in his Tshuvos, he actually quotes the Abi Yosef. What happened? There was a great rabbi, the name of Maran Padova. Maran Padova put out an edition of the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, right? So he put out an edition of the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, and then somebody else came along and put out a competing edition, which was taking away from the profits that the Maran Padova would derive from his edition. This was his thing, was publishing the Mishneh Torah. So said the Rambam, even though the person, it was a complicated case, because the person who published the competing volume of Mishneh Torah was not a rabbinic or even Jewish personality. He was a non-Jew, and then the Ramah has to spend a lot of time talking about whether a non-Jew is subject to all of the same laws that we would be subject to in terms of unfair business competition. But leaving aside, you know, that part of the responsum, the Ramah comes to the conclusion that this act of the second publisher to publish what the Maran Padova had published was prohibited according to Jewish law, and therefore none of the Jewish customers should acquire the Mishneh Torah from the second publisher. Why is that? Because he equates this to the case of the Abi Yosef, where this would effectively destroy any kind of profit margin or livelihood that the Maran Padova would have been able to make from publishing the Mishneh Torah. So this is called Bari Hezek. It's called where the Hezek, where the damage that's going to be caused to the first business owner, in this case the first entrepreneur who is publishing the Mishneh Torah, would be unmistakable. And since it would be Bari, it would be clear and unmistakable. In such a case, we would have a halakhic concept of Hasagas Gevul. Yes.
But isn't this also a case where there's a tremendous investment involved in the publication, and therefore it might be different for that reason?
So this is another question. So there is a kind of another approach over here within how you're going to understand Dugim Diyavi Sira, right? So another way in which you can understand the problem of Dugim Diyavi Sira is according to the father of Rabbeinu Tam. If you just go back to source number 6 that I skipped before. So source number 6 is a lengthy Tosfos. It's a very, very fascinating Tosfos because it talks about whether it's permissible for one teacher to try to steal another teacher's turf, right? If I have one teacher's making a lot of money tutoring some rich Gavir's kid, and another Malamed says, I'm going to steal his turf, and I'm going to try to get that student for myself. So Tosu says that that's considered to be a violation of Ani Hamahapik B'Harara. But if I have a Balabas who really wants the best possible teacher for his student, for his son, and he sees that there's a teacher who's being hired by somebody else, and says, I'm going to snatch that teacher away from that person and get that teacher for myself. So that, he says, he doesn't think is as big of a problem. Why is that not as big of a problem? Because, he says, that's like the Rabbeinu Tam's case of Hefker. That's like Metziah, where this is the only Malamed that he thinks is good enough to teach his son. So since this is a Metziah, so therefore he's allowed to try to pull away, you know, the Malamed who has not yet finalized the contract, shall we say, with somebody else. But I want to focus on a different part of that Tosfos that relates to specifically to your question. Yes.
In the case of the publisher, he's not even taking away his whole business. I thought he just concluded that if he's leaving him part of his business, then it's okay. So the
Ramah is saying that if it's a case like, he's equating this case to the case of the Avi Yosef. Why is he equating this? Because he's saying that what is the real problem in the case of the Avi Yosef? There are two ways in which we can understand the Avi Yosef. One way we can understand the Avi Yosef is that the person who's setting up his egg stand at the entrance way to the alleyway is going to take away all of the business from the guy in the back entirely. There's nothing left. Another way I understand the Avi Yosef is that since invariably there are going to be people who will prefer not to have to walk all the way to the back of the alleyway, so it's bari hazik, it's a sure thing that the first business owner is going to be damaged. So the Ramah seems to be going with that first interpretation. As long as it's bari hazik, it's a for sure thing that it'll be damaged. Even if he doesn't eradicate his livelihood entirely, that's going to be a problem. And the Piskei Tshuva continues, just finish the thought. He continues by quoting the Maaseis Binyamin. The Maaseis Binyamin says, no. If you're going, he doesn't even quote the Avi Yosef, but the Maaseis Binyamin says, when you have a problem, you have a problem when the government only allows for one type of a certain concession to be set up in a particular community, and one person has that concession, and somebody else comes along, and they grab away the right to run that concession from the government, and thereby drive the first person out of business entirely. So he says, that's a problem, because he's Marcheo Legamri, because you are destroying the person's business livelihood 100%. So you can say that's the alternative interpretation of the Avi Yosef, said it would be problematic if you destroy the person's livelihood 100%, if you only destroy the person's livelihood 20%, or 40%, or 60%, so maybe that's okay. So that also plays out in later posting. But let's look at the Tosfos, since I've given you such an introduction, and we'll forget the introduction if I don't read the Tosfos. The Tosfos says that, Omer Rabbeinu, then I'll take your question, in midway through the Tosfos, okay, source 6, I will take it. Omer Rabbeinu Meir, Avish Rabbeinu Tam. How often do you even find out what the name is of Rabbeinu Tam's father? Did you know Rabbeinu Tam had a father even? So Rabbeinu Tam, it turns out, as a father. We know Rabbeinu Tam was the grandson of Rashi, so we know he had a mother, right? Because Rashi only had daughters. But a father? Did he actually had a father? So it turns out he had a father. So here, Rabbeinu Tam's father is quoted, and he says, the case of Dagim, the Yavi Sira, is talking about Demayri the Dagmes. We're talking about a dead fish. So you say, he's swimming with the fishes, whatever. What's the, significance of the fact that there is this dead fish? Like, okay, we have these nice interpretations of now. Somebody's throwing a dead fish at us. So what exactly, what enlightenment are we supposed to glean from a dead fish? It says, no, we're talking about there's a dead fish. She came down the yoga masim and a dog mace, that the fishermen put a dead fish inside of the nets in order to draw the other fish, because this is very attractive. If you're a fish, what's going to draw you to a net that you're going to want to swim in a particular direction, somebody's going to be able to trap you? You put a dead fish there. Who can resist a dead fish? So all these fish are swimming towards the dead fish. It's in the fisherman's net, right? They all want to eulogize the fish, obviously. So they're all going to swim towards that dead fish, right? He did a maisa. He did a particular action. So he goes even further. It's not a question of mazik. It's a question of gazela. Why is that? Because the second person is directly benefiting from a certain product that was produced by the first party. They produced a product. What was that product? That product was the dead fish. The dead fish enables the new fish to be drawn in that particular direction, and therefore the second person, by grabbing those fish, they're essentially stealing, because they're preventing the first person from being able to derive the benefit of their labels, of their labors, of their toil and their efforts in terms of that dead fish. So you could say similarly, if we're dealing with somebody who puts out a particular publication and they typeset it in a particular way and they lay it out a particular way, and then somebody else is going to benefit from that work product. So you could say that according to the interpretation of Rabbeinu Meir, Aviv Shel Rabbeinu Tam, of Rabbeinu Tam's father, that's the problem. The problem is if somebody is going to derive direct benefit from somebody else's work product. And maybe short of stealing somebody's work product, maybe that's not going to be a problem. So what really happens among the later poskim is that they take really pieces of all of these different interpretations. They take the interpretation of the Avi Yosef, that if the idea is that the fisherman's net is teaching me when I'm taking away a person's livelihood entirely, or according to some, I'm just definitely causing harm, so that's already going to be our Sogas Gul problem. According to others, no, what do we derive from the case of Doug and the RBC? What we derive from there, that if a person actually grabs away the customer base that somebody has already cultivated, and they do so actively, as opposed to just sort of putting themselves out there and letting the customers make their own decisions, but they actively grab away the customers, the same way as the second fisherman is actively grabbing away the fish, so that's going to be the problem. And then you have a third group of poskim who say, no, what I derive from Doug and the Abisira, the problem is, if I have a work product, I have a work product that somebody else is going to take advantage of. So some learn like interpretation one, some learn like interpretation two, some learn like interpretation three, and some learn like either like two of those interpretations, and some learn like three of those interpretations, and some say, look in the Shulchan Aruch, where do you find fish in the Shulchan Aruch? Okay, maybe you don't need fish in the Shulchan Aruch, because fresh fish sold here, it doesn't have to be advertised, everybody knows it. But it's not there in the Shulchan Aruch, nothing about the fish case, since there's nothing there about the fish case in the Shulchan Aruch. Right, Ayel, did you see the fish case in the Shulchan Aruch? I didn't see the fish case when we were learning it this morning. Did you see that mentioned? It wasn't mentioned at all, the fish case. So it's not there in the Shulchan Aruch. So some say, therefore, and we see, like the Beis Yosef says, that we would just reject any kind of application of Hasogas Gvul in the final analysis altogether, basically, and pretty much anything goes. So how does this play out in terms of the various postings? So let's turn a little bit further now, okay?
Remember that last point you made?
Yes.
I just don't understand the Avi Yosef and the Pispei Tshuva. So they're basically the Paskin like Rakuna, basically? Is that their reason? They want to follow that? How do you
the According to the Beis Yosef, the Avi Yosef is basically a paskening like Rav Huna. According to the Ramah, and the Ramah is saying, no, even if we hold like Rav Huna Breid Rabbi Yeshua, that's only when we don't have Bari Hezeka. This could be an exception even to Rav Huna Breid Rabbi Yeshua. Yes, we'll be. Yes, after this in Mara, we'll be. Okay? Very good. Yes.
And you partially answered my question, because I think you talk a little bit, that Tosfos, I think, breaks down the idea of product is also a process. In other words, anybody can stick a fish net in the water, but one fellow had the idea, I'll stick a dead fish in, it's bait, that's a process already that's become like an intellectual work product, and I'm sure that...
That's right, if it's your process, then it becomes your work product. That's right, that's a very good insight into what he's saying. That's right.
But I have a slightly different question that I'm a little confused on. You know, we threw out diamonds, teachers in every house in Parkside Estate looking alike. It's civil law, we have an idea of like a general, like you would call a homogeneous product, a dozen eggs, a can of white paint. And we have an idea of very specific, unique products. Piece of civil law, piece of real estate, Picasso painting, 36 Duesenberg, whatever you want to think of.
Uh-huh.
How in halacha do we make such a distinction? What is considered like a homogeneous product that we're not as concerned about for this purpose versus what is considered a very specific instrumentality that we would be concerned about? Because that seems to be
okay,
an important
question
in all of these.
It is, and it's a very important question. And it leads really to another one of the sources that I guess I was saving. But there's no point in saving it now that you raised the issue.
Sorry.
So, well, look, no, not at all. This is exactly what I want to happen. So now if you take a look in, let me find this in the Shulchan Aruch, this is source 9. Okay, we're going in order, which is okay. So if you take a look in source 9, so source 9 says, what was the one case the Rav Huna Breit Rav Yeshua was prepared to concede? Okay, we threw that case away basically, because we said it's not really pertinent nowadays, but the one case he was prepared to concede is when I have somebody coming from another city who's competing with the city dwellers or the city residents who are already paying taxes and he's not paying taxes. So we said that's not really applicable for the most part nowadays. But even when that is applicable, he says there are exceptions to that exception. What are the exceptions to that exception? Meaning even when I would apply a Sogas Gvul, says I'm not going to apply it when it's going to be to the detriment of a third party. Who are the third parties I have to worry about? I have, the customers! Because I have proprietor number one, I have proprietor number two. But I'm not only concerned in the marketplace about the proprietors, I'm concerned about the customers. In fact, the customers generally outnumber the proprietors. If they don't, the proprietors are in trouble. So we care about the customers, right? We have to be concerned about their rights, right? Consumer Protection Board of the Shulchan Aruch. So says the Ramah, that's only if there's no loss to the customer. Where they're selling a homogeneous product. Everybody's selling eggs. The eggs are exactly the same. They taste the same. They look the same. In fact, they cost the same. But if you have a product that's being sold, it can be the same product, but it's being sold cheaper. Not everyone agrees with this, because some say that by definition, if I ever say that it's prohibited for a second person to compete, I'm saying despite the fact the second person would drive down prices, because whenever I have a second merchant, it's going to drive down prices by definition. That's what the Ramban says. So Ramban doesn't like this exception, but the Ramah codifies this exception, where, for example, the second product is cheaper. It's better! Why should the customers lose out from having access to a better product, right? Just not in a local man. Why should you deprive the local of happiness? So then, the proprietor certainly cannot prevent the new merchandise from coming in when it's cheaper or it is better. Okay? So this is right. And then he also says, and similarly, if you have a totally new type of merchandise that comes in from the outside, so you can't deprive the residents of the city of this totally new merchandise. So that also now has to become part of the cheshbon as well. Even if I would have a business that could potentially damage, or I would say it's a barrier zeker, it's definitely going to damage the first business owner, if the quality of the merchandise is better, or it's going to be cheaper, then that also is something that has to be taken into account by a Beis Din in terms of adjudicating this case. So if you take a look, of adjudicating these types of cases, you take a look in the last paragraph in the Piskei Tshuva, which is source 10, so he mentions a situation from the Kassam Sofer. What is the situation in the Kassam Sofer? He's talking about Dayanim, where the Dayanim were not judging the case, but they were the parties, interestingly enough, and the business was that they had a certain hechsher. Now, this is also a type of standard case that comes in front of the Beis Din. One person, one agency, tries to take away hashgacha from a second agency. Type of thing that comes up all the time. You know, we're not only a Beis Din, but we also are connected to a kashrus agency. Could be a conflict of interest, like we were discussing last week. You know, if we have a Sogas Gvul case that's local in the neighborhood, so I think we spoke in the past about how we sometimes have to demur from adjudicating these types of issues when it may depend on whether or not we're the ones who are going to be giving the hashgacha. Now, some other rabbi comes along, and this other rabbi says that, these dayanim are not the best mashgichim. I would be the best mashgiach, and I want to receive the hashgacha myself. So is this a problem of yorei beumnus shel chaveiro, of interfering with the business of your fellow. So in the end, he brings the Avi Yosef and he says, even though we don't hold like Rav Huna, that's only if I have an alleyway where the people could go on either side of the alleyway to purchase from the person in this end or that end. But like the Avi Yosef said, if the new business is going to foreclose the old business entirely, so that is clearly going to be a problem. And he quotes Rashi with respect to the Dagan the Avi Mesira. Rashi says that in most cases, the difference between the fish case and the storekeeper case is in the storekeeper case, the customer can go to this store, can go to that store. Masha Hekam Shainam Bayam Klaro posted can use the Gamni Kopin. So he says that it's very clear that if the livelihood is going to be taken away entirely, so then that's going to be a problem. And then he says, and this is very important, this is the line that begins from the Dovazeh, Upashir Apilu Yeshazeh Od Umna Sacheres or Apilu Ashir Godo. He says, even if the person who's liable livelihood was being taken away has a different livelihood, and even if he's very, very rich, we're focusing on what's going to happen to this particular business enterprise. We don't take the totality of the person's circumstances into account. That's not what a service pool is about. It's about this business. Are we doing the wrong thing in terms of removing this business from this individual? So therefore, he says that would be potentially problematic. So the Chassam Sofer does also seem to incorporate this idea of the Avi Yosef, a Pasuk you say of taking away a person's livelihood entirely into his analysis. You look at the Rashba, source number 11. The Rashba was talking about one person who was a tailor. He was the town tailor, right? He was the town tailor, and everybody went to him. And now somebody else comes along, and he sets up a competing tailor shop. Okay, third line, Aksha Bashimun Megamu Chayet. And he wants to take away, Reuven always did a tailor business with a particular rich gavir in the neighborhood, and now Shimon is soliciting the business of that rich gavir. And he says, I'm even going to do it at a cheaper rate. So says the Rashba, when do I reckon with the fact that it's a cheaper rate? That's when I don't have predatory practices. But if there's going to be predatory practices of soliciting away somebody's customers, so that is going beyond the normal realm of your standard Hasagas Gevul, and that already is in the category of what Rashi called mazik, right? Where you're actually committing a tort of being mazik, of actively hurting somebody else, and not just something which happens by itself, where the customers make their own choice, but the person is actively going after this customer and saying, I know you're already in the fisherman's net, I'm going to grab you away from the fisherman's net, so therefore that's going to be a problem. Let me just read his proof from the fisherman case. If you take a look at the second paragraph of the Rashba, he quotes from the fisherman case, and he says, this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines down, 4 words before the end of the line, the Hakanami. Since this customer would normally go to Reuven the tailor, so whenever he needs his clothing to be tailored, it's as if he's already swimming towards the net. It's as if he's already in the net of the first tailor. So it's considered close to like an act of theft if Shimon now comes along and grabs the business away from Reuven towards himself. No, because he is actively being mefati. He says he's actively seducing this customer to move away from his regular tailor and to transfer his business over to the new tailor. So he says that type of exercise would be prohibited according to halacha no matter what. You're not allowed to actively solicit. The question is, how do you translate that like into a pizza parlor type of case? We go back to our pizza parlor case. So the pizza parlor case is, I have many things going in favor of the second pizza store. Number one, I have a differentiated product. It's not like eggs. I could say this pizza is a thinner crust. Some people like this pizza better than another pizza. I remember we had a case in Washington Heights where there was a pizza store. It was called Pepe's. Pizza store that was in the town for a very long time. And then another store opened up that was selling what was like a luncheonette. But the luncheonette also included pizza. And the question was this a problem of Hasagas Gevul for the second store to open up, you know, a pizza oven to compete with the pizza store that was already in existence? And I remember speaking to Rav Schechter about it at the time, and Rav Schechter said, but, you know, I like the other pizza better. You know, says that when it comes to pizza, some people people will actually, you know, like one more than the other. And how can you deprive the customers, the client base, of being able to choose between different types of pizzas? Secondly, when the second pizza, I think of the example that I gave you, was that it was also cheaper, right? That it was it was selling cheaper pizza. So according to the Rambam, according from the Rimi Gash, if it's cheaper pizza, so that's also going to be okay. Now the Lechem Mishnah, you know, the Lechem Mishnah is the commentary on the Rambam. Lechem Mishnah also has a set of Shaila Tshuvos, a sefer called Lechem Rav, and in that sefer he says, yes, that's all true when the pricing is not predatory pricing. Sometimes you can have what's called predatory pricing. I have a major conglomerate that comes into the neighborhood, and they're going to undercut the existing businesses at completely unreasonable prices that the market can't really bear or sustain. They can't sustain it themselves. It's just that they have reserves that they can rely upon for a longer period of time than the other stores, so they'll price their product low enough that it will, for a long enough time, that it will drive the other business, the other store out of business, and then at that point in time, they'll drive it back up to whatever is reasonable according to market conditions. So he says that if it's, and the Yalka Shokan says this too, that if the pricing is not just cheaper because the market conditions would enable anybody who does their business well to price at a cheaper condition, but it's based on predatory pricing, so that would be problematic. So that's also something that the Beis Din would have to look at, you know, under the circumstances. But generally speaking, the products are differentiated enough that the Batei Din will almost always allow the second pizza store to open. Now, what happens, you've asked me about pshara. So one of the things that Beis Din will do as a pshara is say that even though the halakha may not require it, but in order to maintain this notion of differentiated products, what we're going to do is that we're going to require the stores to operate slightly different businesses. So this one will be allowed to sell falafel, this one won't be allowed to sell falafel. This one will be allowed to have sit-down and not take-out, and this one will do take-out or not sit-down. And they will delineate kind of like these different boundaries. But the truth of the matter is that api halacha, generally speaking, you don't even need that. As long as you have products that taste a little bit different, and where it's not bariyazeka, in many, many communities, you can make a reasonable argument that by having a more vibrant and active business district where there are more restaurants and there are more businesses, that's going to be better for everybody. And if somebody loses out, it's because they probably don't have a very good business mind. Now, what happens? I've sat on a number of pizza parlor cases, okay, because there's no such thing as the best and the nasty, and really mama's pizza cases, because, like, you know, it starts with a pizza. We've had chocolate, you know, store confectionery cases and bakery cases and all of these types of things as well. I remember one of the first thing I ever sat on was a bakery case. I remember the names of the parties and so forth. So we have all these variations, but everybody gets the pizza cases. So what ends up happening is that invariably, the Beis Din will say the second pizza store can open up, and they have to vary their product and their presentation and their name and so forth a little bit different from the first store. And what ends up happening is that usually within a couple of years, both stores go out of business. I can't explain exactly why this ends up happening. I don't think it's the fault of the Beis Din, but, you know, the halakha has to play its course, and, you know, whatever ends up happening. Yes.
You know, in the case of the Rashba and then the Tshuva Chatam Sofer, it was an interesting point, going back to an earlier point. They just assumed in the case of the Chatam Sofer that all the Hashkafot were of equal quality. That one posted, that one of the Mashkifim didn't have superior knowledge or of X, Y, and Z. And in the case of the Rashba, how do we know that one tailor wasn't better than the other tailor? Had better access to better fabrics, had a better stitch, whatever. Those are important things that would play in. And they're just totally glossed over in the various tshuvos.
Right, because the general assumption is that we're talking about the types of industries where there is a lot of similarity in terms of the services that are provided.
Especially in those two industries, there's not.
And where it's very, let me say this, it's very, very difficult. While it may be true that one mashgiach will be able to, and it's a good question, you might have, you know, one tailor really is much more superior, and you might have a mashgiach who is much more superior, but it's very difficult to trust the mashgiach himself who's looking to take away the business from making that type of an assessment, okay? Maybe third parties can make that assessment. Now, what some of the folks can say in these cases is that a person can advertise in general their services and what they have to provide, and then the customers can, you know, read up on what's available and decide themselves that they're going to solicit from that hashkaka, or they want to turn to that hashkaka for their business. But for the hashkaka to actively solicit away, unless the hashkaka really feels that there is, but even then, let's say that you have a very pious hashkaka. and they feel that there is an improper hashgacha that's being used by a particular company, so then if they would move in and say, we have to save Klal Yisrael from this improper hashgacha, the proper course of action would be to say, here are a bunch of other proper hashgachas. We don't want the appearance of impropriety because we are the ones who are pointing out the problem to the customer, so we're not going to give hashgacha, but we are going to direct you to the following two or three other agencies who are available to provide better hashgacha. Because that is much more l'shem shemayim.
Because even that has editorialism. This hashgacha is good, but it holds by certain kulas. We don't think those kulas should be held, so we're advising you X, Y, and Z.
If you feel that it's good, then you shouldn't interfere. But if you feel that it's really not good, that you have, you know, hashgacha, that you have a company that's relying on hashgacha, that's serving trade. One second, guys, I'm almost finished. So then, obviously, you know, you have to figure out a creative way to interfere without it being a conflict of interest. Now, I had a case where there was what time is it? I can't
tell.
Two more minutes. Okay, so let me just tell you this one case. So I had a case where there was a fellow who moved. It's one of the scenarios that I have on the sheet. It was a fellow who moved into a neighborhood as a rub of a shul. And in that community, there was not so much parnasa for a rav to have, but one major way of having parnasa was by giving hashgacha for a major national kashrus agency. Now, it happens that major national kashrus agency also had membership synagogues that belonged to that national kashrus agency. And this person wanted the hashgachos that related to that major national kashrus agency. But there was a Chabad rabbi in town who already was taking care of the hashgachos for that agency. So he turned to the agency and said, I'm your rav in town because I'm one of the membership, you know, rabbis of, you know, one of your synagogues. So therefore, I want you to take the hashgacha away from the Chabad rabbi and give the hashgacha to me. And the agency said, we're not sure that that's really the right thing to do. Let's go to the Beis Din and have the Beis Din adjudicate it. So we looked at the tshuvos and we said, look, there's a clear tshuva from the Maksam Sofer. If you look in source 13, there's a clear tshuva from Ramosha Feinstein as well, which says that this really runs afoul of this business of trying to grab away what somebody already has. The idea of the Dugan DRBC, or what the Rashba says, of a tailor, a Shimon the tailor, trying to grab away the customer from Ruvain the tailor. So he said that even though we certainly understand, and these are good people, you know, but we understand where he's coming from, but halakhically speaking, this is certainly one area where we, you know, draw the limits. So what the Bate Din will typically say, like in the cases of the pizza parlors as well, is that if there are long-standing customers of the first pizza store, it's not right to actively solicit their business away from the other pizza store. You can advertise in the neighborhood, and if they decide to come into the second pizza store, that's their business, but you don't stand next to the first pizza store and actively try to turn them away from the first pizza store towards the second pizza store. So these are some of the different distinctions. These are some of the different considerations. And Yetzer Hashem, maybe next time we'll speak about a little bit more of them, and we'll speak about some of the implications and applications with respect to copyright and trademark infringement cases as well.
In the case of the predatory pricing, if you guys driven out of business, what's this report?